Renate will be the first one to tell us. Yes, I can turn the light.
It's very bright.
So Renate will tell us a personal perspective on time and cosmology.
I should start with Jurek, Frank, and myself have been given the impossible and unenviable task to provide a summary to this very eventful conference. That means, you know, not to listen, only to listen to all the talks, absorb them all, you know, make them cohere, reflect on them, extract the essentials. So clearly impossible to do, especially in this, you know, delivery just on time mode I'm in. So firstly, what I'll do, of course, I provide a personal perspective. And so, well, who am I? Well, that's me. But, you know, I come from a specific angle. And of course, I look at what has been said here from a specific perspective. And I said, I'll present some of my comments, you know, hopefully coherent thoughts on things that have caught my attention and that I've been able to relate to. And in the end, I'll touch on about 50%, I think, of the, you know, questions that the organizers so helpfully posed at the outset of this meeting. So I'm interested, of course, I'll have to tell you, time is very ambiguous, many meanings, many contexts in which time has appeared. Oops, no idea, ships. So we've had strong views advocated. Of course, from the point of view of quantum gravity, there are specific aspects we are interested in. And there was a challenge, of course, set yesterday by Marina to provide what we think is the most important question. Unfortunately, I got a little bit ahead of myself. So here is, from my perspective, the most important question for me. You know, should I think more about time now, or can it wait until my retirement? So what I mean by that, of course, is should I, you know, as a practicing, you know, quantum gravity person, not just, you know, go ahead and just use time as it appears in my formalism, but really think hard about time? Or is it really not all that important? Can we make happily progress in formulating the theory without pondering, you know, time on a permanent basis? So that's, well, I think that's a very, maybe a pragmatic question, but an important question. So we've heard quite strong views expressed from some people from some of the speakers at this meeting. And of course, if one embarks on quantum gravity, there is this almost mystical problem of time one is confronted with, so especially in the context of canonical quantum gravity. So what is this mystical problem of time? Is it just, it sounds like something that's just very complicated and unsurmountable. Should we even get started on this? On the other hand, if one talks to people who come from a more quantum field theoretic perspective, well, they don't seem to care about the problem of time with a capital P. So, you know, what is it all about? So is there a problem of time? And or is there maybe not such a big problem of time? Or is there some misunderstanding? Maybe these guys, they don't understand what they're talking about. Okay, now, we've heard about many different contexts where time appears, and different times, and with, you know, different contexts, and therefore different attributes. So there was psychological time of what we experience. Time in, say, relativistic field theory, in general relativity, where, of course, one also should point out it has a very specific, you know, quantitative aspect. These are quantitative theories of nature. Then we had thermodynamic time, or the time associated with the evolution of complex systems. So one point of view that some people took was, well, so one thing that I've learned, I think, is that, well, many of these different times are kind of, at least a priori, logically independent from each other. You know, you can talk about them separately, but one of the type of ansatz that people have followed also in this conference was to say, well, can we learn from one aspect of time or one notion of time for another one? So, and can we gain insights this way? So there were Lee and friends who say, well, really, we need to look at the universe as a whole. Therefore, time is fundamental, and that will have far-reaching consequences for quantum gravity in one way or other. Then there are people talking about top-down causations. So Josh Ellis was one of them, people that look at and compare arrows of time, and we should maybe deduce interesting things from the fact that some of these arrows of time, you know, coincide. For me, I found the evidence given in support of, you know, gaining insights from these, making these relations, I found it somewhat thin. In the same vein, we had a very interesting talk from Ismail yesterday, who mentioned results from, amongst many other things, that we have from understanding, kind of from cognitive psychology, more about how we perceive time. And there have got fascinating things that people have learned about how it is that we perceive things like a flow of time and a now, right? And how our brain constructs from external inputs and, you know, memories and being, you know, referring to those in a complicated way, which we don't fully understand, some notion of this continuous flow of time. And so there is something we perceive as the now, the flow of time. And one of the questions that has repeatedly been asked is there kind of a quantitative counterpart of these subjective experiences in physical theory? So that means, I mean, beyond just semantics. And this morning, even, it came up in various of the conversations. So here I would say, presumably, we have we are deriving some evolutionary advantage from our senses working in this way. But it doesn't, to me at least, I don't see why, therefore, it should follow that, you know, for all these other many notions of time, especially the physical notions at the very, very large cosmological scale or microscopically, that should give us any insights. Yeah, so we should not be surprised if this is not the case, certainly at this extremely large or extremely small scales. And the fact that maybe these notions of time don't relate in a very direct way to our everyday psychological impression of time does in no way diminish these theories. Of course, it makes it maybe a challenge to explain these theories using everyday language. But that's not a necessity. So, you know, I happily take in face a parable from this morning, I happily take the role of the naive scientist who says, well, you know, please provide me with the evidence that I should learn anything from, you know, making aspects of subjective time appear in my theories. Can I really learn something from that for the theory? I'm doubtful, but I'm happy to be persuaded. Otherwise, should new evidence come along? So, of course, in particular, another thing you could say, one could suspect is that maybe the way we are conditioned actually, of course, forms a bias to how we even formulate our theories. So if I knew better what the neurophysiological kind of correlates are of these perceptions in my brain, I could maybe, you know, try and get rid of some of this bias and maybe have a more unobstructive view on the real nature of time. Who knows? But of course, that's just idle speculation, and insights like that are probably very, very far away. Okay, now let me move on. Therefore, this was one of the questions that was posed. Does the present moment have an objective physical meaning? Well, perhaps not. Now, time asymmetry of the universe was one of the grand themes of the meeting. What we find is that our fundamental physical laws seem to be all time symmetric. So in order to get time asymmetric physics out, I have to have, you know, some initial conditions. And here, you know, I have then an additional prescription where I take these laws, and then I pick the right branch from my cosmological solution, so those that expand instead of collapsing. Well, that's not so serious, but in addition to that, I have to pick special initial conditions. So why do I have to do that? Well, the simple argument is, well, the entropy in the beginning should please have been very low, so then it can grow and we can have a second law. Well, the question is, does that constitute an explanation of the initial conditions? Well, in the first place, I don't I don't think it does. To me, in the first place, it's fine-tuning. So there was Andy Albrecht, who yesterday complained about, you know, the vagueness of arguments surrounding this and some lack of technical rigor also. Of course, one has to ask then also in what context is the argument of the initial conditions being made? I mean, typically it will be some kind of cosmological or perturbation context with, you know, severe truncations of the degrees of freedom. But more than that, of course, I'll have to specify, well, what is the space of all possible initial conditions from which I'm choosing? So what is, you know, what is a suitable probability measure? And with respect to what kind of measure does a specific initial condition appear natural or generic or whatever I need? So, well, that's a challenge, and it's not answered typically, you know, within these somewhat restricted, these cosmological models. Of course, I can ask, for example, would a theory of quantum gravity provide me with an explanation of these initial conditions? Well, that might indeed be. First, there was another point. Okay, here. So, yeah. So one way out or suggestion was to say, well, regard the initial conditions as part of the law because we're talking about the entire universe. Well, that's fine, we can agree to do this. It doesn't help me in the sense that it doesn't get rid of the issue of fine-tuning. So can we derive the current initial condition by slightly earlier ones if we really, you know, once we have a kind of full theory of quantum gravity? Well, maybe we'll be able to do that. However, it seems the fine-tuning problem is likely to get aggravated because, of course, I will then have many more degrees of freedom. I have to tell, you know, why those get fixed to a specific subset, you know, so that what I want to happen comes out in the end. So I don't really see how this problem, as a matter of principle, can be resolved. So unless someone, you know, magically comes up with a qualitatively really new dynamical principle, quantum in nature, some kind of, you know, meta law, some fitness function which please be reasonably unique, yeah, to settle this problem, we really must face the possibility that, you know, that we cannot within physics ever explain or derive the initial conditions. And therefore, you know, physics in that sense will then also not be causally closed. But I think that's a very realistic possibility.
Isn't that true of every problem in physics?
What?
Every problem. You could always say, this is
sure,
the problem we'll never solve.
Sure, this tends to be, I mean, the beginning of the universe tends to be,
it's
just another problem. Yes, Neil, to you, it's just another old problem, you know. I don't disagree with you. Of course, it doesn't make the issue go away, you could say. Okay. Anyway, so where was I? Emergence. So is time fundamental or emergent was also one of our key questions. So I call it here the challenges of emergence. So we had various people contrasting, you know, different levels of we should consider in our theories, which might be subject to, you know, bottom-up versus top-down causation. And in particular, Barbara Dressel was very much emphasizing the difference between reduction and emergence, or strong emergence, as she called it. Now, I think it can be quite illuminating to make these distinctions for certain purposes and see what happens in your own specific theory. To my mind, certainly reduction and emergence are in no way mutually exclusive. However, what seems to me the case is if we now look at more specific cases of emergence we are genuinely interested in, specifically in a gravity, quantum gravity context, there are very few explicit examples of emergence of time or any other aspect of space-time, which you would like to have emerge. So here I don't mean just the emergence of an era of time in already some, you know, pre-existing universe. I really mean, you know, emergence of time as a concept, whatever, presumably global time, from a kind of microscopic theory where it wasn't present a priori, say, you know, at the Planck scale. So I will consider the issue of emergence, therefore, in the context of non-perturbative gravity, and that's challenging and difficult. Now, quantum gravity hasn't appeared as much in this conference, as I would have liked, maybe, or as I'm used to, hanging out with my buddies at all these quantum gravity conferences. Now, so quantum gravity here has often appeared kind of as the ultimate savior. I have my favorite thought about what should happen to quantum space SEM at very short distances. Well, of course it will. There will be no time. There will be no space. Of course it won't be unitary. Of course it won't be local. Of course it will be fundamentally discrete. Now, and I wish quantum gravity will explain this favorite outlandish property of space-time at the Planck scale X, which I'm wishing for. Well, that's a hope. Of course, a key problem, even if you have some model that kind of microscopically maybe incorporates some of these outlandish features, the key problem is then to actually say by what mechanism, dynamical or otherwise, then our favorite properties that are known to be present on macroscopic scales will emerge from such quantum dynamics. So locality, causality, entirety, space-time, properties of space-time as we know them. Now, of course, I cannot let the opportunity go to point out to you that there are specific theories in which this has been studied concretely and quantitatively. They have been studied for almost 30 years, and they make some quantitative statements about emergence of space and time, time as part of space-time. So it's not just a self-advertisement of what I'm, it is also that, of what I'm interested in, but just to say, well, such things are around. Yeah, and if you don't work in quantum gravity, you might not actually be familiar with them. So I'm doing that very quickly and in a way that probably will leave hundreds of questions, unanswered. So what is the game called? It's called dynamical triangulation. So what it is a quantum superposition principle taking a path integral over curved geometries and thereby, defining a dynamics of a system of in the easiest case, pure gravity without matter coupling, from which hopefully, as one of the properties, some classical limit will emerge, but which will also enable you to study really, properties of quantum gravity and quantum space-time in a Planckian regime. So you have dt, this is dynamical triangulation. There's another version with a cdt with causal dt. So why are they interesting for the current context I'm discussing, emergence? Well, they provide insights in what I would claim is generic behaviors, kind of an entropic nature, generic mechanisms of the emergence of both time and causal structure. So this is just a way of doing the path integral, you could say. It's non-perturbative. You are performing an integration over all curved spacetimes. Individual spacetimes are kind of regularized, so you can do this integral. So you get a curved spacetime by gluing together little tiny identical building blocks. So that's one of them. It's a triangular thing. It's a fourth simplex, a four-dimensional triangular structure cut out of Euclidean flat space or Minkowskian flat space, depending on what you look at. And then your task is to assemble all possible inequivalent way of gluing these things together with all kinds of curvature properties. And essentially, the measure is basically this is one. So it's a democratic sum over these things. And what you're interested in is not the sum as such, but a limit of that sum, where you let the short distance regulator, which gives you the size of your building block, so you let that go to zero, and simultaneously you take the number of all of these objects, building blocks, to infinity, and you check whether there's any interesting limits exist. So the first that people did in this version, they did a Euclidean version of that, which is kind of a version of Euclidean quantum gravity, where these complex phase factors are actually real Boltzmann weights. And this is here, how does it know its gravity? Well, first of all, of course, the curvature degrees of freedom are captured in the building blocks, and then we have the Einstein-Hilbert action here. Yeah. So you have gluing rules that tell you how to assemble these things, and they're very generic. You just put them together, so you get something that looks manifold-like locally. So it looks like a nice space at the level of the cutoff of these building blocks. I should point out, in no way should you think of this as fundamental discreteness. It's just a scaffolding, like a lattice in a lattice theory, which I will shrink away in the end, and only the physics properties that interest me are the universal properties that survive such a continuum or scaling limit. So in particular, there's no fundamental discreteness postulated, unlike, for instance, what we saw this morning Faye talk about. So what happens when I take these superpositions? What do I learn for emergence? So let me first do the Euclidean thing. So it's a timeless formulation. It's a timeless statistical-mechanical model where I glue together little pieces of Euclidean space, glued together so that curvature ensues. So I'm summing over Riemannian curved spacetimes. And I can study them because I have Monte Carlo simulations available that will enable me to make some quantitative statements. Do we find any evidence for emergence of time or causal structure from this quantum superposition that didn't know neither of time nor of light cones or causal structure? The answer is no, we don't. And even worse, there is no way I can tune the parameters, the free parameters, the bare coupling constant of this model, such that in any of the phases, in the sense of a phase space of this statistical mechanical model, a four-dimensional extended geometry emerges. So instead, what happens is that the quantum geometry of the system likes to arrange itself in very bizarre and highly degenerate states. It either polymerizes, depending on how you tune the inverse, the Newton constant, and that minor branch polymer is kind of something that has dimension two, or it goes into a kind of crumpled phase where everything crumples around a little vertex in your triangulation. Neither of these appears to have any interesting classical limit, and nowhere ever does a four-dimensional space ensue. Therefore, no space-time, no time, no causality. So it's uninteresting. So what I have done is kind of falsified something that looked like a viable quantum gravity theory, but there doesn't seem to be any interesting classical limit in it because of non-perturbative entropic reasons. Now, I can do something slightly different. I make things causal. What do I do? I change my Euclidean building blocks to Minkowskian building blocks, so I know what about light cones, etc. And I change the gluing rules only mildly in a sense that I forbid ill-behaved causal structures of individual path integral histories. So what do I forbid? Well, I forbid that space splits into several components, branches out in a way that's depicted here. So time direction goes in the vertical. So I disallow these things. Of course, I need to give you a notion of time. So here we are back to time in order to suppress those. But I could give you any notion of global time. If it's true with respect to that, it will be true with respect to all of them. So I have here a discrete notion of proper time in my triangulation, and it helps me to label kind of layers of the universe. Then I ask, of course, what becomes of this time in an infinite volume or scaling limit? And you would say, well, of course, if you're now putting in time, clearly it will come out in some way, right? But again, it's more subtle than that. So what happens is not necessarily will time come out in a continuum limit. So what happens instead? So that's my oops. Yeah, I wanted to do this the other way around. So I find a phase structure that depends on two bare coupling constants, and I find three phases ABC. Only in one of the phases is there an extended spacetime that emerges, and also something I can call a time. Yeah. So it's characterized by these what we call volume profiles. So it's simply kind of plotting the dimension of the three dimension, in this case it's kind of compact slices, three spheres, plotting these as a function of time. So here I have in phase C something that emerges and I can measure it. It has scaling dimensions, so here time is always horizontally. So it's something that starts at some point and it extends to the kind of round blob and then it vanishes again. So for the duration that space volume is non-zero, there is something I can call a time, and I can actually identify it with a global cosmological time. So my parameter, which you know had, of course, had some features of time in the discrete model, assumes a physical meaning. What happens in these other two phases? Well, the system had what I would call a potentiality of time, but it's not realized. What happens? In one of the phases, space-time zooms together into a single slice, delta t, of minimal duration. So you see, although there's time kind of everywhere, but I mean, when I'm out here, I have no idea what this time means, you know. And here is a space that is kind of infinitely extended and exists only for an infinitesimal time. I don't have a classical interpretation for that. You have yet something else where things, you know, fluctuate so heavily that, you know, a volume of space and space-time exists for a tiny second, then it zooms back together to zero. And again, this is nothing that has any interesting macroscopic qualities. So we've learned here that, well, I can make time emerge, but it seems that at least in this class of models, there are some necessary conditions for me to do that. So here we had to put in, a priori, a global notion of time and assume some restrictions on causal structure to get anything interesting out at all. And of course, very importantly, with respect to this notion of time here, I can also show my model is unitary. So of course, if I didn't have such a global notion of time, I could never make any statements like that. And that's, of course, a very important thing to be able to say. Now, therefore, time, you know, I'm converging to a point of view to say, well, time, at least coming from the arguments of this context, appears to be fundamental, essential. I want to make one added argument, that is, timeless formulations tend to be very complicated or sometimes and or intractable. So let me give you some examples. I can just study, you know, Newtonian mechanics, and I just can just say, let me eliminate time from all the equations. It's just this stupid absolute time of which I know it doesn't exist anyway. Well, I can do this. I can re-express the dynamics all in terms of relative distances. It just, I can do it, but it just gets damn complicated. Now, there is shape dynamics about which we've also heard at this conference. In a similar spirit, I eliminate time and I want to re-express the entire dynamics as a function of shapes, you know, variables. But of course, in an infinite dimensional context, I get a Hamiltonian that is non-local. Well, maybe it can be tracked or treated and understood in some way. Now, that is nevertheless a difficulty. Another example is of getting rid of time is striving to preserve the reparametrization invariance of GR in the full quantum theory. So this leads us to the whole story of canonical quantum gravity, Wheeler-DeWitt equations in full quantum gravity, one attempting to represent the full Dirac algebra of the constraints, infinitely many constraints. That seems also a very an uphill battle, which we haven't won in any way. Lastly, of course, the example I gave, you know, Euclidean quantum gravity, where I didn't find any time emerged. So I gave you the example of the dynamical triangulations, but people have studied Euclidean cosmology, quantum cosmology, and never, you know, some people may disagree with me, but never anything very interesting came out of that. So that brings me, therefore, to my tentative conclusion, so that some notion of time and global time appears to be, you know, if not you know, essential, at least extremely useful, definitely in the context of quantum gravity, and we could therefore conjecture it actually to be fundamental. Now, at the very last, you know, a comforting thought, being timeless is maybe not the way to go, but time is here to stay.
I probably should have warned before starting that since the speakers are to summarize time, we leave them in control of their own time, so they get to decide how to spend the 30 minutes, how much time they want for questions, and how long they want to talk. Now, Renate took one extreme and showed some very interesting things, which means we only have time for about three short questions while Jurek sets up his computer. And I see George has the first.
I just want to draw something on the board to show the problem. If there isn't a passage of time, here's a block universe, here's a world line, and here is my present time here. Now, what you have to think of if there isn't a evolving block universe, as I suggested, is that there's a spot there, and then a minute later there's a spot there, and then a minute later there's a spot there. You have to think of a spot, as it were, moving up there, a red dot moving up along that line. And what you have to do is somehow explain how you've got a theory with no time, but my consciousness is going up there and telling me that's the time. Not only that, there's someone next to me with whom I'm talking who similarly has experiences of time that move up there, and you have to explain how does that other person have experiences which fit.
Yeah, what was the question?
What was the question, and how was it relating to the talk?
How it would fit into my worldview. Well, maybe I don't have necessarily the ambition to describe. I haven't fully understood the gist of your argument.
Yeah.
And why should my physical theory capture exactly that? I don't know.
I think it's a little bit along George's line, but maybe even more extreme. I think the one thing I'm really sure of is that I'm here. In your comments earlier in the talk,
it's hard to argue with. Yeah.
I hope you are too. Sure that you're here. You may not be sure about me, but you're fairly sure about you. So at some point in your talk, you said, what am I going to learn about my discipline based on these philosophical discussions about whether or not, there is a time or not? And I would just turn it the other way. I mean, physics is a theory which tries to explain as much as we can possibly explain from as small, few number of principles as possible. The fact that I am here is the one thing I'm really sure of.
Yeah.
I better try to explain it.
Well, that depends on what your ambitions are. But of course, I'm not saying it's impossible, and also saying these things are not related. I can just argue pragmatically. You see, where do I think that within a reasonably short time, say until my retirement, I see, really areas where I believe it's fruitful to look at, to learn something. And I haven't seen the very convincing arguments, for instance, that would say, with trying to relate, our perception of time, our feeling of flow, to relate this to the physical theory is a very fruitful thing to do. Maybe we don't know enough yet about the process.
Would help Einstein do things. Your role is to help.
My role is to help.
Do it yourself.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
So there's no point in closing down.
No.
Amazing questions.
No, but life is finite, right?
So this
my
discussion
is my life is finite.
Who cares about you?
This discussion
I care about it.
Is getting metaphysical. So I think we'll thank Renate again for her summary and. The next bias summary will be from Jurek, so.
Oh, yeah, hello. I'm scared to death because I never done that. I don't know what to do. What I'm gonna tell you is that essentially what I don't understand. And to be more precise, I will try to tell you mostly about the questions I am bringing home with me to think about and try to understand, apart from the tons of papers that I actually notice are interesting and I will try to read. The summary is biased, and I will explain in which sense it's biased. I would like to explain first what was my initial position, which actually happens to be my final position. So I kind of subscribe to the general views that I would like to tell you later. But since Lee, when Lee invited me to do that, and I think it's a great honor to do that, Lee actually asked me to tell you about some surprises. And the major surprise of this meeting is actually that nobody ever mentions Saint Augustine, who actually, you know, this citation is the first sentence of every book on time. My personal take of this is this, this poor sot is actually deceiving himself, that he doesn't know what time is. Actually, which makes me a little bit happier than I was at the, during this meeting, because I don't know neither. So I'm in a good company. So, but then, of course, I mean, forget about these little questions. The major prior question, which I think I should ask actually to explain what my bias position is the question what time we're talking about. So first of all, there is, of course, a time of philosophers. This is something I more or less copied from the entry of some encyclopedia of philosophy about Kantian time. So this is essentially the initial question that Kant asked himself. So I think it's a good list of questions that philosophers would, or metaphysicists would ask themselves, which is basically what time is. Is it real? If it exists, does it have independent existence, or it depends on something? Are future and past as real as present? Is time dependent on relations among things or independent? Is present objectively real and time flows? This is this A and B definition models of time, or now it's not objective and real, and time doesn't flow. And essentially, and also, if time is somehow external to the mind, what's the relation between time and mind? Well, certainly, and this is one, well, one of the part of the one of the side of the coin of my bias position. I think this list of questions is extremely interesting and deep and hard to answer. But these are not the questions that physicists ask themselves. These questions do not belong to physics. So what is time of physics? Well, in order to...
Kant also asked whether time has a beginning or is infinite.
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course. There is a huge list, long list of questions you may ask yourselves. The point I want to make is that these questions, in some sense, do not really belong to physics. And at risk of being a little bit extreme, I would say, well, that physics is a natural science. Natural science is aimed at discovering how nature works. And in order to be able to say anything about nature, something that can be confronted with our observational experiments, we really need to make sure that all notions that we're using are operatively defined. So think this is actually the basic equation of physics, and most of the physics that you know of is essentially some variation of this scheme. So what is time here? What does it refer to? Well, it's not absolute time or independent time. It's a reading of a clock. If I want to check if this equation is valid, I am saying that, well, this is the force that I can measure somehow by, I don't know, a scale, for example. This is a distance that I measure by some ruler. And this t is a parameter that I measure by some clock, which means essentially that, in fact, in physics, what I'm talking about is not... it's not time, this abstract time of philosopher, is the reading of the clock. Which means that, I'm sorry, but perhaps it's a little bit too extreme, but I would say that in physics there is no role of time, doesn't really play a role in physics, and because there is no time, there is no problem. But of course, this would be a little bit too extreme or a little bit too radical, because being physicists, we of course ask ourselves some questions that in principle, I mean, from this kind of very radical definition of what natural science is, all they're like kind of this kind of a murky land or slippery land between philosophy and physics that I called metaphysics. All right, so there are some questions that are of interest, and some of these questions were actually implicitly or explicitly asked here, or at least I picked up from some talks. So if time exists, right, suppose there is a time in the sense that some independent entity which exists independent of anything in the universe, if it does. So what is the relation between time and physical clocks? So what do clocks do? Do they measure that? They measure something, it seems. Do they measure this time? And in fact, when we're talking physics, and in fact, that this is something which that puzzled me many times during these talks, was the question that I actually already asked several times. When we talk about time, are we talking about time, the time, this abstract time, or are we talking about reading of clocks? And I had already some discussion about it yesterday with Carlo. And then one of the questions, that there was some kind of a phenomenological time, and well, I don't understand really much about that and the past hypothesis. But I would like to, and this is the question that I think you can do with me back home. What is the operational meaning of the phenomenological time, and what is the operational meaning of past hypothesis? There was something that David Albert hinted at. And I think this is kind of an argument that you can try to construct in favor of the notion of this, you know, this basic something that I called ontological time, something that exists independent of all the stuff on the universe. Actually, the question is, and this is something that this is a kind of interesting question. So it's a little bit puzzling. Why all clocks that we know of actually work well? So if you have something that we call good clock, they work well. Does it mean that they measure the same thing? Even so there is something behind, or there is some other reason why these clocks are mutually consistent. Then there was a series of lectures. So I should have said it at the very beginning. This is my really personal set of problems, the personal set of things that I didn't understand. I will not talk at all about lectures and talks that were more physical, because then I basically understood. Apart from some reference that I thought that I would read. So this is about something that I didn't understand. So there was a session of emergence versus fundament, and Stuart Kaufman said at some point that you cannot reduce Darwin to Einstein, or Darwin to mathematics, or Darwin to physics. And, well, I would say that for me it's intuitively obvious. So if somebody meet me on the street and ask me, do you think you can reduce Darwin to Einstein? I would say, well, obviously no. Clearly not. But then I started wondering, so what is the argument that you cannot? Well, cannot in principle or in practice? Well, certainly not in practice. I think it's kind of obvious. But if it's impossible in practice, then you know, it's kind of weak form of impossibility. But if it's impossible in principle, then I don't quite understand why. Also something that I think actually was implicit in the Stuart talk was some deep relation between emergence, in the way he understands it, and time. So emergent must have time to emerge, right? That there is some process. So I wonder, what does emergent telling us about time? I have no slightest idea. I mean, this is something that I cannot really pin up very clearly. But I think there is something deep about this, about emergence and about time. And last but not least, I said at the beginning that my review is going to be quite short. There is this cosmological theory of Lee and Roberto. And essentially, if I understand correctly, the challenge here is to find a theory, or, well, I'm not sure if theory is a good term, to find some description of of everything. So find a theory of everything that exists. I mean that the theory, meaning the theory that, as Lee stressed it many times, a theory of a system with nothing outside it. Well, my view is that it goes, and I think it's kind of obvious, but perhaps I'm wrong, perhaps it's not obvious. I think it goes far beyond the subject matter of contemporary physics. Because contemporary physics is about, as it was constructed by Newton and Galileo, it is about the local system. That's how it was. It actually how it was defined. And I think that I sympathize very much with the comment that Roberto made at some point, that if you're really seriously thinking about this theory of this kind, you really don't need mathematics there. That mathematics is completely unnecessary. Well, in fact, I would think that if you really seriously consider constructing system like this, you really need to start from scratch. So you need to go back pre-Newtonian, meaning pre-scientific, and try and start to constructing everything from scratch. But then, so this is kind of, I mean, I would say that this is something that is extremely ambitious and exciting project. This is a project of really finding some metaphysical, closed metaphysical system of everything there is. And to my knowledge, the last system of this kind was formulated by Spinoza in mid-17th century. So, but I think so perhaps it's a good time actually to revisit this kind of a grand problems. But then the problem actually I am facing here, the immediate problem I am facing here is what I think might be apparent clash, but perhaps I don't understand it well enough, between two statesmen. One is that there is a theory of everything, so everything there is, and also Lee stresses, as he stresses many times, time is, right? So what's the ontological relation between time and the universe? Lee tried to explain it to me, but I'm afraid I couldn't really understand it. So I think that this is the question that I should really think more about. I think that this program is absolutely, absolutely exciting. And that's essentially everything. I think it's, well, I don't know, perhaps your disappointed that I have not that many questions arising from this wonderful meeting, but well, that's the way it is. That's what I remember. And well, I think that I should finish with thanking Marina, Lee, and Roberto for this wonderful week we had here. Thank you.
Stephanie.
Yes. Okay. Actually, we certainly need, must thank Stephanie, because I bothered her with tons of emails, and she was so patient in answering all of them.
Okay, and we've got roughly 15 minutes for questions, and I think the first one is for Faye. Afterwards, it's Carlo, and then free for all, and especially if anybody has not said anything yet, it's your last chance.
The way we understand the world is through our best physical theories, and our best theory that involves time, or our best understanding of time, is from general relativity. So it's a theory that I think the consensus is that it's our best understanding of space and time. Would you mind going back to your slide in which you say that we must understand everything in physics in an operational manner?
Yes.
So in general relativity, time is proper time along world lines. Space-time is a physical material. It exists. It's the entity that the theory is about. Time exists, it's proper time along world lines. And we understand the every textbook on general relativity doesn't, as far as I know, does not define space-time in operational terms. Let me challenge you. So how would you explain, how would you understand and explain the recent LIGO results?
All right. So when I don't agree with you that every textbook in general relativity doesn't start with operative definition. I would think that every book in general relativity, every good book in general relativity actually starts with that. So the proper time is defined as the proper time. If you really want to measure proper time, that means that you take a clock along with you, and actually the proper time
I
is
don't
what
disagree
the clock
that
measures.
If you want to measure proper time, you must use a clock. But the theory of general relativity is about space-time. That's what it's physically about, just like electromagnetism is about the electromagnetic field. If you want to measure the electromagnetic field, then you need to use an apparatus. But the theory that there is an electromagnetic field, that's what the theory is about. So general relativity is about space-time. So can you rise to the challenge and explain in an operation, using only operational notions, the recent LIGO results?
Well, it would be some task, but I still don't.
But it
really
must be done, right? So,
well, it's operational. Okay, wait, hold on. What is operational about the LIGO result is that they see that the ruler, so that the distance between two mirrors changes in time, which means that the distance that the ruler kind of a practical ruler actually sees changes with respect to the reading of some atomic clock. This is what LIGO sees. We have explained.
That would be a really boring paper.
Sorry?
The importance is there's a story.
Well, I know that the importance is that, well, sure, I agree that the story is crucial. But the story is all. I mean, there is no physics. I mean, story is not the whole of physics, right? The story must tell you how you can, in order to verify things. I mean, that there was some of discussion about verification, falsification. But in order to verify, falsify, you really need to know what you're falsifying and what you're verifying. And what you're verifying, you are verifying or falsifying the reading of your actual apparata that you use in experiment as compared to the predictions of the same reading given by some theoretical, by some theory. So I would say, of course, I know this radical, so I don't want to defend it. I will not give my head for that. I will not lie my head for that. But I think that it's important. It's important part. So every story to be called a physical theory must really tell you how to measure things, that how to measure what are
but
the reading
what?
Of apparata corresponding
measure
to
measure things that exist, real things.
I am not sure that this is already a metaphysical question if these things exist.
Just before Carlo, a reminder. Even in the last session, please ask for the mic if you have a comment, otherwise it's not recorded.
What do you say? Oh, the mic.
Please still raise your hands. And
okay. Jurek, no, please stay on that slide.
Oh, stay, yeah.
I need that slide and then the following. Jurek, I liked a lot the things that you summarized and the points that you, but I also do want to challenge you on that with a couple of factual comments, not metaphysical comment, both factual. Take them as factuals. So the factual comments is that when Newton introduced that equation in his book, he goes over and over again to say that this is not the reading of a clock. He calls the reading of a clock in his own language relative time, or everybody's time, or as a same. And then he says, this is what we read on a clock, and it takes a while. But, he says, I pretend that there is also, and I could translate in modern terms, it is convenient also to assume, to make the hypothesis, there is something else, which he calls absolute time, which he says very strongly is not the time that clock sees, okay? Which is very good and very convenient to, it's much more clear for space, because for space, he says a position, there is the relative position, which is a position with respect to the Earth. There is position with respect to the carriage on which I am. And the absolute position is not something which I see, but nevertheless, I want to make a theory about that. So he goes on and on that equation has a T which is not observable T. That's it. Can you go to the next slide, and then you see why I
Here it is?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, so it's very beautiful. You the last thing you say: if time does not exist, why different clocks seem to give mutually consistent readings? In fact, one of the points of Newton is that out of all the, to some extent consistent, and there's a long story, there's no need to go through, reading of the clock, we can deduce that it's convenient to think that there is time, Newtonian time, common. Okay, now what about if for some physics? For instance, the physics that Neil was describing in his talk, clocks sort of, each possible clock, because of gravity, jumps back and forth quantum mechanically. So when you go to small scale, clocks just intrinsically do not give a consistent readings. Well, the world could be like that. If the world was like that before quantum gravity, then we would still have clock readings, of course, because, you know, what time is, I know what time is it. What I know what is time, is 5:20. But we would, this quantum gravitational incoherence at small scale of the clocks that Niels point out would prevent us to do the move that Newton says very clearly is to make an hypostatize, to assume that there's something like there, which is not the thing. I mean, Newton goes over and over and over again, says beyond, if you want to do physics, it's convenient to postulate the existence of a time, which is not the thing of your. So perhaps we cannot do that,
but
and we just remain with the clock.
Not.
This is a possibility.
In what sense it's not the same thing?
It's the same as position, right? Newton wants to say the Earth moves. So what is a position? I mean, position is changing. My absolute position is changing, but not my relative position. But Newton wants to say there is an absolute space down there. Mm-hmm. And there's an absolute time. So we are located in space where there is a time that passes even if no clocks moves, and I postulate that, and then I describe each one of my objects as moving in, and some the objects are the machines that approximate at best possible my postulated times. That's Newton. Remember that before Newton, there was no space, no time, there were only things located one with respect to the other one, and that changed one with respect to the other one. So the possibility of thinking at space and time without the location and movement, relatively. Relative is a word that Newton uses. He's not saying that it's wrong, but he's saying that beyond the relative position and the relative change, there is a... Do I have to stop?
Just get to the point. You've been speaking for 4 minutes now.
It's pretty clear. You're giving a perfect story what it means that you do physics without time. It means not taking that line of Newton, keeping the clocks, which we are forced if clocks are not coherent to one another down the Planck scale, as Neil was pointing out.
Yeah. Well, I agree that the story I'm telling here is of course classical. Right. I mean, I believe that this, and this is our current understanding. Right. We really don't understand what the quantum story would be. And I think I agree with Laurent, for example, that the quantum story would be dramatically different. So that there is something I would expect something completely different would emerge from from quantum theory of time. And this example, that the theory that you presented, this little thought experiment, I think it's a clear indication of that.
So a last comment on this from Lee, and Adam can come forward and start setting up for the last provocation of the conference.
I think it's one way to answer a long speech about Isaac Newton is with just mentioning Ernest Mach.
Short and to the point.
Let's thank Jurik again.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me. You overheard my private conversation.
Well,
that happens sometime, you know. In politics, it's a
Okay, last talk by Adam, and I'm sure there's a lot of supporters of the case of anarchy in this room, so.
So first of all, I just want to say thank you very much to the organizers of the conference for giving me a chance to speak here. Obviously, most of you guys don't know me because I've never really worked in this field. So I really appreciate the opportunity because it's something I've thought about, you know, from a distance. That's sort of the second part, observations from the outside. So I appreciate the opportunity, and probably after this I'll never be invited to another one of these conferences again, but you know, what the heck. So the title is A Case for Anarchy, and I'm responding to Sean's lovely way of sort of formulating things of, you know, conservative, radical conservative, and so my case here is, in general, I'm trying to argue for in observing the field, and that's a part of this is also just my observations of the field as a participant in this conference. First time I've been to one of these kinds of conferences from the outside. And what I'm going to argue for is, one of the things I see is how much reasons there are to really think, you know, the conservative, the radical conservative is great and can be continued, but also the radical, or even, you know, the going even further. So first of all, for those of you who don't know what I do, why am I even here? I'm a computational astrophysicist. I study star formation. I also study exoplanets. So this is, speaking of time, here's a nice little clock. This is a exoplanet, a hot Jupiter orbiting a star, very short orbit. The star is in red, and the planet is so close to the star that the ultraviolet light basically evaporates the atmosphere. And this is something, there's lots of data now coming up. There's already data that actually allows us to study this. So, you know, what do? I compare models or these simulations to data. And that's going to be actually an issue I want to talk about. So the thing I also want to talk about here is that, so there's a lot of talk about, like, you know, physics and philosophy. Well, we're physicists. Thing is, you guys are more than physicists, right? You're working in a very unique domain of physics, right? This is not, you know, putting a box on a table and, you know, running fluids through it and asking about, you know, its viscosity, right? This is, I love this book, right? I'm sure a number of you probably have articles in this book, but I got this years ago, and I just think, like, wow, what a title, right? Science and Ultimate Reality. Should never be able to say that without reverb. But that's really kind of what's going on here, right? This and probably quantum foundations are the place that you're not just doing science, you're not just, like, running through doing physics. I mean, that's part of it, but there's also this way you're touching on some of the deepest issues where the questions of physics touch questions of ultimate reality, right? And so that's why, you know, asking about the metaphysics, you know, both, and I mean that both philosophically and sort of metaphysics, becomes really important. And so the interesting thing, I really like Janann's bringing up the Necker cube, right? This idea of, you know, here's this cube, it all depends on how you look at it, if it's coming towards you or away from you. And, you know, what I've noticed in this conference is, as people would bring up different kinds of ideas, you'd see, you know, the room sort of gather into one or the other corners of the Necker cube, depending on how one felt about it. But the idea was that, in general, no matter which, you know, idea came up, you know, whether we were discussing emergence or upward causality or reductionism, reversibility, people tended to, as a, you know, group, in the same corner of the Necker cube, depending on their, you know, sort of their global metaphysics, right? So you'd see almost everybody who had a certain idea about emergence or, you know, or reductionism in the same place, right? So that there's sort of, we all have these sort of, you know, we come to physics with these metaphysical intuitions or biases, or we want something to be true on some deep level, and that's how we choose then to do our physics. We choose those issues. And one of the things I guess I'm just arguing for here at the end as I review or think about what happened is the idea that there's, you know, I think there's really arguments for, as much as possible, you know, breaking out of that to some degree, at least allowing for research programs that break out of that. And so here's my arguments for the longest. So the question is, why explore new metaphysics? Why look for new, you know, philosophical underpinnings that will then drive research programs that look very different from the research programs that exist? Now, of course, the research programs that exist have, you know, some of them have yielded amazing progress, you know, like, you know, what's going on with loop quantum gravity. But, you know, there's, even in all of them, there's, you know, things have been gained. But there's, I think there's arguments that really an emphasis or, you know, resources or support for even just encouragement of different, you know, programs that would come off these. First of all is data, lack thereof, right? So I've, you know, been going to scientific meetings all my life. Wow, you guys don't have any data. You know? It's really amazing to sit through 4 days of conference and have so little contact with, you know, with some data, with some information. And that's it's nobody's fault, right? That's just the nature of where. What? Yeah, right. I know, sort of as a theorist, you're like, hey, this is awesome. Yeah. And so I want to say, you know, that puts the field in a very sort of special place that is, you know, exciting in some ways, but also very dangerous, right? And there has to be real attention to the possible foibles that can come out of that, right? So, like, you know, I'm not so interested in formal arguments about what falsification means or are we Popperian or not? But what we really, of course, want is just a prolonged, multidimensionals. You've got a lot of different kinds of data from a lot of different directions. And getting beaten up by that, right? You know, those, you know, whenever all of you have had some contact with data in your careers, right? And you know, it's a very humbling thing to have some idea that you had just be like, whoa, that was totally wrong. It's very helpful. So this tussle with data, and it's gotta be more than just validation of a prediction, right? There's gotta be some, because, you know, as we saw with, you know, that can happen with, you know, sometimes with particle physics is like, oh, you know, it wasn't seen in that particle accelerator, we just push it off. We just tweak knobs and push it off. So there's got to also be the possibility of having things fail in multiple ways. And if you don't have that, here's the thing I think that's interesting. So, you know, I think a lot about philosophy. I think a lot about the sociology or the history. I've done some of my books have been about the history of physics. If you don't have that, you know, being beaten up by data, then you're very susceptible to what I would call generational sociological effects, right? So we talked about the Bohr-Einstein debate. Bohr and Einstein were contemporaries, right? They both come up together. They were senior scientists. You know, everybody was like, oh, you guys are awesome. But, you know, they could fight each other, and it was okay. If you have more than one generation of scientists go through without data being eliminating somebody's idea, then for the young scientist who comes in, all they have to judge is sort of the reputation of the scientist based on what, right? So, right, exactly. You have to impress the senior person. And so this senior person, right, and there's been no, the senior person who, you know, maybe a brilliant mathematician or whatever, has never had this contact with data. And so that's how you can end up with these streams of, you know, fashion or, and it's just, it has to be watched against so much if you don't have, I mean, data, having lots of data naturally is a filter, right? So that's one of the, and especially I've been thinking a lot about this, about the idea of once you have the second generation, that's when things really get dangerous, that you can have, you know, obviously, like, you know, you look at the history of medieval philosophy, you had, you know, you could have things going on for, you know, hundreds of years, streams of thought with no filter. Scholasticism, for example. Now, some people will argue, well, we don't really need to do, you know, explore new metaphysics because of the historical success of the quote-unquote conservative approach. You know, and there's clear, I mean, the conservative approach obviously has led, you know, wonderful places, but in some sense, it's only as far as the standard model, right? The standard model was the last place we had, you know, this enormous flowering of success, and, you know, it's been, 30 years, 40 years since a theoretical program at these frontiers has sort of had that amazing contact with observation, allowing it to be filtered through. Now, inflation, some people would say, well, yeah, that's an example of the conservative approach, field theory, et cetera, leading interesting places. And I think that's true to a point, but as we'll see, you know, and some people will argue that, you know, inflation still requires fine tuning. And, you know, one of my arguments is to the degree to which people think that inflation also implies eternal inflation in the multiverse, then there's some real problems that have arisen. So I think, you know, one has to be careful about this. And also it's a category error because all of that success was for stuff in the universe. It wasn't really about the universe as a whole. And so even taking, you know, when we talk about cosmology, often we mean large-scale astronomy. And large-scale astronomy is still different, because large-scale astronomy never asked the question, right? The Big Bang theory is not a theory of the Big Bang. It's a theory of what happened after the Big Bang, right? So that's still sort of, you know, you have a big bowl and you're watching what's happening inside the bowl. Whereas, you know, this next step requires what is the bowl, right? What is the contents into which all of this occurs? All right, so my next, sometimes argument will also be, well, you know, it's a really hard problem. It takes a long time. You know, quantum gravity, you know, going beyond the standard model next steps, it's a really hard problem, so it takes a long time. Of course, it is really a hard problem, and it takes a long time. And, you know, that has to be acknowledged. You know, however, one can ask, you know, trying to extend from the standard model and quantum gravity, are they historically unprecedented in how long it has been that there hasn't been this sort of, you know, leap forward where there's an established model that has been filtered through by data, right? And I'm thinking about it, and I can't find, the only one I can think of is perhaps the ether, that you went two generations of scientists without this occurring. So people, we can talk about this afterwards, but, you know, it seems to be taking, my argument would be it's taking a long time, okay, and there's good reason for that because it's hard, but that's even all the more reason to say, like, well, maybe we should be really approaching some other things, right? Oh, if it's really that hard, then maybe it's possible that it's that hard because there's something that hasn't been seen and some other approaches might be really helpful. This is also, I love this term, from Sean, ontological exuberance. So this gets into the idea, you know, with some of the sense of like, oh, there's some real problems with some of the approaches, right? So what I'm going to formally say this, models in the field, in, you know, the field that has been the topic of this, have been deemed successful, and yet they contain ontologically volume-filling new actors, right? And so, you know, if somebody said to me, oh, you know, Adam, do you have a theory for how stars form? I say, yeah, you know, I got this great theory. It explains all the data, but it requires two pink elephants on a planet around Alpha Centauri, right? You'd be like, well, that's kind of weird, but, you know, okay, you know, you explained all the data, that's great. But if I, you know, so that's not ontologically, I haven't added a whole bunch of new, I mean, even there you might think, like, that's too many new actors. But I haven't added a whole bunch to the universe that was really sort of does, you know, some violence to your sense of what exists in the world. Adding, you know, an infinite number of extra universes that all may have different laws of physics is kind of adding a lot, right? I mean, that's a lot. And now, of course, if you can find experimental evidence for that, great, right? But if some of these are, you know, if that's going to take 40 years, right? Or if, you know, you only have a very thin way of doing it, or if some of them are actually, you're not even going to be able to measure, you know, or so, right. So whether these new actors are sort of not observable in principle or in practice, then one can say, like, look, that really is a failure. That's a failure. So I do not agree with the idea that, like, if you've explained this thing, this piece of data, that these other things you have to accept coming along for the ride. They're too big to accept to come along for the ride, not without having lots of data, right? I'm only gonna believe those when I have lots of data. And because of that, then you say, like, well, okay, well, let's see if we can examine some really radical other approach and see whether or not we can explain that same piece of data without all the other, without the infinite numbers of pink elephants, okay? All right, so what, you know, one of the things that has happened at this conference is that there has been one particular program of, you know, new metaphysical, you know, program that has new philosophies behind it has been proposed, right? And we've talked about it, we can talk about it more, but I think the important thing is this doesn't have to be the only one. What's nice about, I think, what you guys have done is that you've offered, you know, the beginnings of a program that can be played with. And actually, in a second, I'm going to, you know, what Stuart and I were talking, I'm going to, you know, sort of say, like, oh, here's something you could do. But I think there's others as well, right? And that's the use of having philosophers here, right? Good philosophers and historians, too. Jimin is not here now. But, you know, her work I thought was also interesting to examine what other ways, even if they're really radical, might we might select out something that could be useful in physics. In some cases, they won't be useful for physics, right? We'll just be like, oh, that might even be true and interesting, but I can't see how to do anything as a physical program. All right, so the one place that I think, you know, there's a bunch of things that in the Smolin and Unger program that are interesting, but this idea of eternal laws and the role of mathematics in physics is something that's important to me because, you know, I'm a lapsed Platonist. When I was I remember this quote from the Durant, you know, their book, The Story of Philosophy, when I was 16, and it was about Spinoza, and it was Einstein apparently, in describing Spinoza, says his philosophy was, as the law of circles is to all circles, so is the God to the universe, right? And that is what stirred my heart as a young physicist. I was going to be able to read the mind of God in some atheistic way, right? And I think you scratch under the surface, and a lot of us came into the field for this reason. We believe that the laws are somehow different from the universe, and that's what makes them so beautiful, that they're, you know, this world of change and decay and suffering and sorrow. Yeah, but beyond it, there's these laws, and these laws don't change, right? So, you know, the important thing is that in this idea, which I think is so fundamental to us, that law and structure live above or apart the universe it determines, right? And so one approach, which is what Lee and Roberto are suggesting, is what happens when you let that go? What interesting things might happen if you let that go? And so Stu and I were talking about this. And so one of the things here is this importance of metaphor, right? It's the beauty of going to other, you know, other philosophies, and, you know, because there's a philosophy behind biology, right? Ideas about time and change. So in biology, right, or in evolution, you've got this idea that you have genotypes. The genotypes lead to phenotypes. The phenotypes are subject to selection criteria, and then you end up with a new genotype, right? So that's great. Okay, is there any way we can play with this and turn it into a model or something? Now, the interesting thing about this is note that the DNA by itself is not enough, right? If I had a jar of DNA that's not going to do anything. What I need is the egg, right? You already need to have the rest of the world already existing to allow something interesting to happen, right? So the egg has to exist in the world. And what that means is that survival is at the level of a whole, right? It sort of changes our focus. And the whole is what carries along the parts, right? So, you know, Stu has this, you know, points us to the idea of the Kantian whole, which I had to ask him, what does that mean? That the parts exist for and by means of the whole. I find that a very interesting, different way of thinking than the usual sort of physicist way of thinking about things. So, you know, when we were talking last night, we were sort of poking around this idea, what would a universe look like, actually, with changing laws? What would happen if you had a universe where, like, parts of it had, some sector had a certain set of laws or constant, a different sector had a different set of laws. And so we were, you know, bouncing around the idea, and what we could at least see was that there was, you know, that this, we'd have this isomorphism, right? You know, the laws, just as genotypes produce phenotypes, the laws produce different universes, or it could be sectors of the universe, and then there's some selection criteria, and then you end up with the winning universe, right, or the winning universes. So one thing you could imagine this in a temporal, so this is something that Stu and I thought of, like, hey, could we produce a toy model of this? You know, you can imagine that you have universes where, you know, that are being released, so to speak, or a universe that is being released, allowed to expand, but the conditions in it are such that it's going to recollapse and bounce. And every time you have the bounce, you have a change in the laws or in the constants. And so what you can imagine happening, and actually I think Marcelo Gleiser actually did, he had the idea of a temporal multiverse. Every bounce produces a different set of laws, and they, you know, the bounce makes it as so far and then collapses again until you get one that has the right set of laws and constants, and it releases. 10 minutes? Okay. Yeah, I won't even go that much farther. So, you know, this is an idea. This is the universe that wins. This is the universe you live in, right? And this is, the, you know, the one that wins is the one you see, right? So, you know, this just allows, oh, yeah, maybe we could come up with a simple model for this and hopefully be informed by people who actually do cosmology as opposed to Stu and I. But it was just, you know, the exercise of thinking this way, you know, sort of pushes you into new domains. And it also pushes you not only into new models, but really, you know, some really radically and interesting ideas. Because what this means is the laws are immanent, right? Immanent rather than transcendent. Right? Immanence means to exist or operate within, right? It's inherent to. So it changes the entire way you sort of think about governing laws. The laws govern, but they're part of the system, and the system changes them. They are, you know, inherent to the system. So, you know, Stephen Hawking famously asked, what breathes fire into the equations, right? And the usually way we think is sort of like, oh, we're going to derive the equations of the universe, and they are sort of, you know, they will then give the universe. And the other way, this is the other way around. The universe always, in some sense, there was always presence or existence, and the laws at any particular instantiation of the universe or every were part of it. You needed the universe to have the laws. So I find that very interesting, right? So now I'm going to get you very angry at me because I'm going to go off the deep end, right? So very quickly, I want to say that, you know, so that's one kind of metaphysics. There's lots to be done there. But I just want to say my own personal interest is, you know, one can ask how far and how deep can you go with this idea? But let me just really mess with my underlying ideas of what my underlying philosophy. So in general, when we talk about physics and philosophy, we're limited to a pretty, you know, to a certain line of dialogue in philosophy. And it's particularly the Anglo-American analytic school. And there's the whole continental school of philosophy that really just never makes it into our conversations, right? And, you know, some can say that's because it's got nothing to say to physicists. But I think it's worthwhile. So there's people like Bergson, who has been brought up before. But then also, I'm particularly interested in phenomenology. And some of you have heard me go on about this. I won't spend a lot of time on it. But Husserl and Heidegger, they were very interested in time. Time was essential, right? Heidegger's giant tome is Being in Time, right? They're very interested in time, and they came at it at an entirely different perspective than the kind of analytical, examination of tenses, what is the meaning of tenses, that we're used to in physics. What comes out of this is the idea that there's a certain way in which experience is irreducible. Experience is sort of where you have to start, and you can't really get to, you can't analyze experience by breaking it up into pieces, because that's not what experience is like. Experience is in some sense a totality. And the objective frame from which we usually do this kind of analysis in science is super useful, but it's fundamentally a view from nowhere and no when, which nobody ever experiences. And so, you know, you have to treat it for what it is, which is as an asymptote, but not experienced. So in particular, it actually throws the whole way of looking at the scientific project open. And so Michel Bipol, who is an interesting phenomenologist who's thought a lot, who, you know, is a philosopher of science too, I just want to read this to you and then I will end. He's particularly talking about the whole process of science, of what happens in the objectification of experience, this totality of experience. The creators of objective knowledge become so impressed by its efficacy that they tend to forget or minimize that experience is its starting point and its permanent requirement. They tend to forget or to minimize the long historical process by which the contents of experience have been carefully selected, differentiated, and impoverished so as to discard their personal or parochial components and to distillate their universal fraction as a structure. So what this means in some sense is a way in which some of the raw material of experience gets bled out when we do science. So I just think that's interesting. I don't know if there's anything that could be useful for it, but it's something I'm going to be thinking about for a while. So I'll end by saying thank you to all the organizers, and thank you guys, all the participants, for allowing me to be here and all the conversations. I really deeply appreciated. And as the Canadians say, big fun, eh?
Okay, one quick. Oh,
it's. Here is Stephanie Mole. Perhaps there are people in the room who have never met her, but I'm sure there's nobody in this room who has not voluminous email with her. So she's come up and let's thank her. Nothing. Thank you.
Okay, now back to the questions. I've already taken the first question, which is going to be Raphael, but as the chair of the session, I'm going to allow myself to make the comment that I think taking the generational effects into account is quite important, because if I'm counting, I'm a third generation quantum gravitivist, so certainly a lot of generations without any experiment.
Yeah, so there's one thing I've been thinking a lot during the conference, and taking this opportunity to say it, by way of introduction, let me say, I'm glad that in your talk you mentioned suffering, And I'm also you'll see why in a second. I'm also glad that you mentioned other philosophers and analytic philosophers like continental philosophers, phenomenology, Husserl, and so on. But even that is very limited. And I think one of the themes, if there is a theme of this conference, is we've been asking ourselves, how can we free up our thinking in ways that may be needed for quantum gravity? One way to do that is to take account of other traditions, people who have grappled with the same questions but have come maybe with a different point of view. And there are such people, but they're not in Europe. And there's old there are long traditions. 2,500 years ago, people were debating, is the past real? Is the present real? Are both the past, present, and future real? And so on. So I could say more about this. The particular one that appeals to me is actually, I would say, has influenced my work, is the Buddhist doctrine of what's called conditioned origination or dependent origination. I don't want to talk about, but I want to give something a little concrete to the conclusion. So one of the disputes that took place within the Buddhist philosophy, which is a long, 1,500 year or more discussion and debate, was it precisely the question, is the past real, is the present real, if all three? I think there was a school that said all three were real, which was called, I believe, the Sarvastivadins, if I'm not mistaken. But there was another school that gave the answer that's very close to what Faye was saying, to what George was saying, and I think someone else also said that. They were called the Vibhajyavadins. And what they said is that the past was real, and maybe the present, if you include that as a separate thing, but which is what I believe, I think. But they went a little farther. They were quite subtle in the way they said the present is real, and that part of the past which retains its causal efficacy. So this, I think in a certain way that ties up all the themes that have been exposed at this conference.
Can I respond a bit? Because, I figured I was already going out on a limb far enough that I didn't want to bring that in. But it's absolutely true. The idea that philosophy is, like, the only philosophies we should be discussing are the stuff that was done by, white guys in Europe, is there's these other civilizations that developed, a tremendous amount of very sophisticated discourse on this. The Vedic traditions, Buddhism, I'm particularly enamored of Dogen, who is a 13th century Zen master, but there was an enormous amount of work he did trying to unpack. What I find most interesting in the Buddhist philosophers was the relation between the relative and the absolute. Right, there was a lot of understanding of I am an individual experiencer, an individual phenomenological agent, but clearly I'm part of the world too. So this is not idealism. So I think there's stuff to be mined there. And unfortunately, I think what happened historically is we had the Tao of physics and stuff, which was wacky, right? And so it made we can't even talk about that at all. And now it's time to understand what metaphors, what lines of argument might be useful for us, because it touches on a lot of the stuff that we do. Right, but with a different focus often.
Often with a different point of view. In fact, if I could put a small plug for causal sets, the doctrine of dependent origination or conditioned origin is the closest I've seen in philosophical literature to a description of a causal set.
Yeah.
Okay, Francesca?
Okay, I have two comments. One is about philosophy and one is about real stuff. So let me start from philosophy because this is... I started from philosophy because this is what we were discussing just now. So I think that the example of time is one of those in which you can see how you can meet a certain philosophical tradition. And so I personally take the point of view that time is emergent, that there are several times, and every time you say I talk about one time or the other, you should always specify with respect to which observer. And I think that the idea that specifying the observer or specifying with respect to what you are doing or your evolution or with respect to which observer you are testing a certain system in quantum mechanics is an example of the fact that declaring a particular point of view, declaring a particular standpoint, is not something that weakens your objectivity, but it is actually the way in which you gain objectivity. So in this sense, I think that... So this is my philosophical contribution. And I wanted to I want to take the time also for another comment, because Lisa pointed this out, that we are a third generation scientist. We don't have data? No, we have data. We are full of data. There are quantum gravity measurements. We know that Lorentz invariance is not broken till a very, very, with a lot of digits. We know this. So it's not true that there are no data. We are not, so we cannot do theories in which we break Lorentz invariance freely. These are already pushed out of the realm of physics.
But that's not data. I mean, that's a different kind of data. If you're just saying, like, I've already got a bunch of existing knowledge, and now any new model I come up, of course it's got to.
No. So I'm saying that there are models that of quantum gravity that has been falsified.
What?
Yeah, and for instance, also in loop quantum gravity, we had different schemes to treat perturbations in cosmology, and some of these schemes have been excluded by observation, and some other are better for fitting the observed data. So no, it's not true that our generation doesn't have data. We are facing them, and we are doing. So there are some people that are concerned with those things.
It seems to me, I mean, other people can address this or not, it seems to me there's a paucity compared to, and the ability to actually, again, this, you know, knuckling up under, because again, existing data, just saying I have to recover the data I already knew before I even started this process is not, because of course, you know, when Einstein invented relativity, he had to recover Newtonian gravity, right? I mean, that's, so, I mean, you know.
Raise your hand, please, Carlo. Since it's my point being attacked, just to make it precise, we don't have any data that, as far as I know, we don't have any data that has killed a theory. All the quantum gravity theories are still clinging onto life. Okay, well, that's a longer discussion. I think George wanted to say something.
That was a lot of fun. Can we just go back to your bouncing universe picture?
My bouncing universe. Follow up. There you go.
Yeah. I think the second line there, it should be laws, universes, selection to laws, if it's going to be the same as the one above.
Oh, you know what? You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. That it should be genotype. Yeah. Or so it should be laws. Thank you. That was a mistake.
Turn it on.
You have a lot of data.
The last 3 years, we've probably had more data in fundamental physics than in the previous 30. So we have lots of data from LHC, from Planck, measurements of dark energy, LIGO. We're swimming in wonderful, wonderful data. I think what is true is that we had a gap. There was a gap in the rate of acquisition of data went through a slow period before the last 3 years. And I think what happened, for various reasons, about 30 years ago, is that theory diverged from experiment, especially in particle physics. And so young theorists grew up without much interaction with data. There was a ton of model building, you know, going back to grand unified theories and string theories and all kinds of other theories and arbitrary scalar fields and blah, blah, blah. And this has occupied a large number of people for a long time. And I think part of the fact about this meeting, though I haven't been here much, Andy has been my spy, and he tells me there hasn't been much discussion of data, and this is a real reflection of the nature of the community of young physicists, and I very much hope this will change, because now we have data.
All right, well, I'm willing to update what I said based on that.
Okay, we should probably start winding down. There's a lot of fingers right now. I gave the second microphone, and then it's, okay.
I just wanted to say that I love the analogy between the biology and the universe, but I've always had a problem with the genes are actually a physical entity where laws are not. So I always kind of want to say, where can I find that physical entity to go to the next phenotype?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer for that right now. I mean, in some sense, the gene, that's true. The genes are a physical, you can say, one can also speak about the information encoded. You know, in some sense, the genes are the information they encode. And as a quantum theorist, I said, you know, told me that genes, or information is the spiritual quantity in physics. You know, in some sense, you could make that link of just that it's information that's being passed along here. I'm not sure if that's exactly a one-to-one. But even in this, I still think that as a research program, right, you know, so this outlines a possible, you know, we can imagine doing a bunch of models of this, whether they're, you know, this is a evolution in time between universes, or you could try and do space-time domains and ask about how, you know, with interpenetration, they're competing against each other, they change each other's fitness landscape as they compete. So again, Stu is, you know, this is all, I'm channeling Stu here. But that would be, right, let's make those models and see kind of what comes out of it and, you know, how interesting it is and if it leads us in new. And then, of course, the most important thing is that it leads us in directions where there is data, right, where it suggests things that we hadn't even thought about places, you know, under the rug to look for. That would be the best, right, if this research program.
Just to emphasize what Francesca said and what Carlos said, I absolutely agree. 15 years ago, we could make theories of quantum gravity, of quantum space-time, in which we implemented the very natural idea that if space-time was discrete, there would be violations of Lorentz invariants. And the data only constrained those at the level of 4 or 5 orders of magnitude away from the Planck scale. So we were free to make such models, and there were many such models. In the last 5 years, the data, for example, from the Fermi satellite, from Auger, and from other, have gone up to the Planck scale and to a factor of 5 to 10 beyond the Planck scale. And all those models are in the waste paper basket. We could hope for more and hope for better, but this is in the realm of the things not said. There's a whole lot of things that could have been discussed at this meeting were it not for those experiments.
Well, thank you for that. So I will update, you know, I mean, so that I look forward to being educated on that by you guys, because I was not aware of that, especially, you know, the degree to which you guys would argue now, that now there is these discriminants, right?
Okay. So, well, comment to Francesca and to Lee. There are new data, and Giovanni published a paper months ago with the observation of neutrino times of light, and he claims to see the effect. The statistic was very low for the paper, but I was told unofficially that the statistics is better now, and the effect is there. So. I mean, we are serious. I mean, this is a serious stuff.
Your
reference
is IceCube data?
Yeah, IceCube data, yes.
Sorry, what is the effect they are claiming?
They're claiming the energy dependence speed of neutrinos. Ultra high and energetic.
And let's not forget minimal supersymmetric extension of standard model, which are
very close to being killed by data. And if you wanted something humbling, here is the greatest example.
Right, right. To what, let me ask you guys, though, to what degree is that really eliminate, and what models does it eliminate in terms of quantum gravity? Because I get different, you know, responses to this. So what, I mean, you know,
okay.
Does that really kill a whole category?
Last comment by Neil now, and then it is 6. Some people might want to end the conference at some point.
I think it's given a lot of string theorists a serious pause, and as probably the main consequence is that their attention has shifted to condensed matter.
No comment.
Last word. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming, for working with us these last 4 days. And certainly, no agreement was reached. No final conclusions were come to. But our fondest hope, if I can speak for the organizers, is that the conversation started here will continue. And especially those that between people who didn't know each other very well before this week. So thank you very much. And Happy Canada Day.
Merci. No theories were harmed in the making of this conference. Thank you.